Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to a double author feature at Syosset Library's Turn the Page. First, we will interview Renee Rosen about her book, Park Avenue Summer, followed by Nicola Harrison and her historical fiction Montauk set right here on Long Island. This is
Evelyn
and Jessica, and we're here with
Renee Rosen.
Renee Rosen, and this is Syosset Library Turn the Page podcast. How are you doing today, Renee?
I'm doing great. How are you both?
Good, thank you. And I just finished reading Park Avenue Summer, and it was so good. I absolutely loved it.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thank you.
Yeah, it was fascinating reading about Helen Gurley Brown and her assistant. I just loved it. It was just such a great story. Very interesting.
And going into summer, it's always good to read a book with the word summer in the title.
Yeah.
So how did you come to write about Helen Gurley Brown?
Well, it's funny. I actually was binge-watching Mad Men.
Oh, okay.
And I knew that I wanted to set a book in New York during that time period. And I was searching for sort of a sexy, glamorous industry to set it around. I knew I couldn't do advertising because
right.
Mad Men obviously had that. So I started thinking about magazines. And initially, I was just going to do a fictional magazine that was really struggling and a group of marginalized secretaries who ended up sort of turning the magazine around. And I was talking to my editor. And it just sort of struck us both. It was like this blinding glimpse of the obvious, Helen Gurley Brown and Cosmopolitan.
Right.
And then we were kind of off and running.
Very good. Yeah, it was very interesting. I looked up the book that Helen Gurley Brown wrote, Sex and the Single Girl. I haven't gotten
right.
a chance to read it yet. I never did read it. I'd really like to, though. So I'm sure that was a helpful piece of research for you.
Well, that was actually where I started. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had the 50th anniversary edition. And, you know, parts of it still hold up. But, you know, we have to put ourselves back in the mindset of 1962, mm-hmm. where a woman, you know, saved herself for marriage. And here comes this, you know, relatively unknown woman who's giving all these single girls a license to go out and have sex.
Right.
And, you know, it sent shockwaves through the whole nation, you know, and sold like 2 million copies in the first month. And, you know, Helen became a darling of the radio and TV shows, except the host wouldn't say the name of the book over the air. They didn't want to offend their listeners or their viewers. But, you know, she talked about sex the way other people talked about the weather. And she was the first person who was, like, having this dialogue. And, you know, so, but some you'll find when you read it, you know, like some of her advice, she gives makeup advice and how to keep your apartment, make your apartment sexy.
Uh-huh.
You know, what made a sexy apartment versus a non-sexy apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of her beauty tips are just hilarious. As are her recipes, because no one cared less about food than Helen Gurley Brown.
Right. I mean, you say she used to eat her salad by her fingers, and all she would eat was lettuce. I mean, did she eat it
right.
all?
She would. A splurge for her was an extra helping of diet gelatin.
Oh, boy.
Oh, so that's too bad.
You and I did.
Wow. She
She was very much into deprivation.
Well, she liked
yeah.
sex, but not
when,
food.
She deprived herself, of every, you know, everything but sex.
So. Right. Yeah, and her husband was also very famous. He seemed to really, I mean, she needed him so badly for someone who wanted to be independent. She sure depended on him.
Talk a little about, so who was her husband?
So her husband was David Brown, who was a famous Hollywood producer. Some of the movies that he was involved with, in no particular order, include Jaws, Driving Miss Daisy, A Few Good Men, Chocolat, Valley of the Dolls, And she met him, and you know, she just decided he was the one that she wanted, and she reeled him in. It took about 2 years, and the book kind of goes into her strategy of how she got him. But you know, it was, David was sort of the force behind her. After they were married, David said, you know, you were the most fascinating single girl I ever dated. I think you should write a book about that. And that's what became Sex and the Single Girl. And then she was getting so much fan mail, and she couldn't keep up with it. She'd be up till 4 a.m. writing back to everyone. And he said, you know, if you had a magazine, you could talk to your girls once a month. And so
and have more time for
around.
Sex.
right, because that was always, you know,
if
that was priority
up,
one.
If you're up till 4 a.m. writing back to your fans.
Yeah. And, you know, so they finally, Cosmopolitan, which had been around since the 1800s, was really struggling. In fact, they were going to fold the magazine. And David Brown was the one that convinced them to give Helen a chance as being the editor, even though she had no magazine experience and no editorial experience. So, and, you know, Hearst was just terrified that she was going to come in and turn the magazine into a version of her book, which is exactly what she did.
Right. But people loved it, and it's still going, still thriving.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
But it is ironic that, you know, this woman who was a feminist and very independent was also very dependent on her husband.
Right. Very. You showed in the book, definitely, how she needed him. Like, she wanted him on practically what we call speed dial now. That's how she wanted.
Yeah.
She wanted a direct line right to him. And the part that confused me, that anytime she had a meeting in a restaurant, she had to have him there in the restaurant at the same time. To me, that was like so, that was unbelievable. Like,
now, was that because of social standards? Did she feel that that people took her more seriously with him present?
He was there strictly as a safety net.
Okay.
That if one of her meetings was going south, he could just kind of slip in and save the day. So, you know, she was very insecure about, you know, some of her dealings. It took her a while to find her sea legs as an editor. And, you know, David wrote all the cover blurbs in the beginning. You know, she ran every article by him. And they used to have these nooners where they would go, if she, they called them nooners, if she was stuck somewhere, you know, in terms of the magazine, she would get together with David, they would have their nooner, and she would come back with the answer.
Is that the origin of the term nooner? Because I remember hearing
it a while back
and being like, oh, what is that? Oh, is that what that is?
I think it's just what she called it, but I don't think she originated it.
Right. And the main character in the book, where did you come up with her? I mean, what was your, did you know about, it's a totally fictional character, I'm assuming.
Right. And I think, you know, when I started working on this book, I wrestled for a short period of time of whose point of view should it be? Okay. Should I just tell it from Helen's point of view? The only problem with that was there were so many books out about Helen Gurley Brown, and so much was known about her, not to mention her own books that she had written about her own life. And I thought, well, I can't really bring anything new to the party then. I'm just sort of rehashing through a fictional version. But by introducing this character of Alice Weiss, who, she's a young girl who leaves her hometown in Youngstown, Ohio, and moves to the big city to chase her own dreams and ends up as Helen's secretary, using her as a vehicle enabled me to sort of show the impact that Helen Gurley Brown had on a young girl who, you know, arrives to the city or wherever she might be, you know, kind of green, and all of a sudden her world is just opened up. And, you know, not only her romantic conquests and her, you know, questionable affairs, maybe with some office workers, co-workers, but, you know, just her view of life in general, her confidence in herself. And, you know, using Allie in that way enabled me, I hope, to show another dimension of Helen Gurley Brown and her legacy and her impact on women, In terms of where Ali came from, there's probably, and I didn't realize this until after the book was written, but there's probably a little bit of me in Ali, because I grew up in Akron, Ohio.
Okay.
And I had always wanted to be in New York City. That was just a dream of mine. So I think that sort of longing for a big city experience sort of came more out of my own life than I even realized. The rest, all fiction.
Okay. Did you achieve your dream? Did you end up in New York City?
I did. I lived on the Upper West Side for about a year. And then I got homesick for Chicago and I went home. But now every time I'm back in New York, I get New York fever.
Well, Chicago's a great
city.
Chicago certainly has its own flavor as well.
I think it's a great city. I was there for ALA 2 years ago. Love Chicago.
It's interesting just when you talk about, you know, historical figures like Helen Gurley Brown and, you know, fictional figures who kind of jump on the wind and, you know, are able to give us a fast pass to that world in a way, I guess. And, you know, you can consider it self-insertion, I suppose. At the time, I guess when you were writing it, you didn't even realize. When you were talking about binging Mad Men, so many women I know were so inspired by that Peggy Olson character, who was fictional but very loosely based on a few women of the time.
Well, you know, she was based on Helen Gurley Brown.
Yes, yes, but didn't
but
she?
That fascinated me. I had no idea.
She did. Didn't she have like one or two? I'm trying to remember. I feel like there may have been one or two other people she was based on, but I do know that there was a huge bulk of her that was based on Helen Gurley Brown. It just I know a lot of people who went into the show watching it were kind of unaware, and you know, like Peggy Olson has become a lot of people's like inner courage, a lot of young women.
Yeah, she's our hero. She's our, you know. And, you know, because Helen had 17 secretarial jobs in 5 years.
Wow. But that was, but that was like what you were supposed to do when you, you know, other than go home and bake cookies for your children and greet your husband with a whiskey and a kiss.
But she was so smart, though, because she, when she went to work at this ad agency and she was working for the head of the creative department, and he gave her a shot at writing an ad, she recognized, like Peggy Olson, that was her opportunity, and she made the most of it, you know, and shortly after that became like one of the first female advertising copywriters. And she used all that in the magazine too. She used all that marketing savvy.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and I always like stories like this because like sometimes it shows how far we've come, but then at the same time not, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like you know,
2 steps forward, 1 step back.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because there's you know still people, you know, women would want to pad themselves with men to make their voices heard in a lot of cases. So I always find these things very interesting. And you're talking about Sex and the Single Woman, you know, being, you know, simultaneously, you know, like groundbreaking, but then you look back on it and, you know, you could see that it was of a certain time. I always compare that to
absolutely
books like Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan, which, and even like Kinsey's work. I mean, at the time people were like, oh my God, this is
so shocking.
This is so shocking. This is so, you know, like you can't talk about this stuff. And people were outraged and people were intrigued. And then when you look at it now, it's not as groundbreaking as it was back then when these
we've become desensitized. It's not, you know, as things are so tame by today's standards.
And I think
things that shocked.
Sure. And the voices, you know, like Friedan and Kinsey were coming from, you know, like these academic standpoints and, you know, like more well-to-do backgrounds. And I think now, like, we're, you know, we're listening to so many different people's stories. So I think like things like this, like they're all like, you know, like Brown and you know, they're all good conversation starters. And that's like one of the things I love about, you know, these stories.
Well, if it wasn't for them, we probably wouldn't have Sex in the City.
Not at all. Like, no, right? Yeah, not.
Well, that was based on Sex and the Single Girl.
Right.
That book was, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so Helen's legacy is definitely out there. Girls, the HBO special or series, rather, that was based on Sex and the Single Girl too.
Wow.
So, you know, she sort of gave everybody a license to, you know, get out there and express themselves. And if that was in a sexual way or in a way you wanted to wear your hair or your makeup, you know, she was just encouraging women to make the very most of their lives, which was the same thing that Betty Friedan was encouraging and Gloria Steinem. And yet the three of them didn't like each other.
Oh,
so,
wow, really?
You know, they were, you know, they wanted to bring women together and yet they couldn't all get together.
Right.
You know?
Which is unfortunate because they are all iconic in their own way.
Absolutely.
And you know, they were the building blocks of, you know, this feminist movement,
right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I actually had no idea that they didn't like each other.
Yeah, that was sort of a surprise to me too. And it's like, you know, I'm not surprised that Betty Friedan and Helen Gurley Brown wouldn't have seen eye to eye, even though their messages were very similar. It was just their way to the end result were different.
Right.
You know, they had different paths. But, you know, I think that, you know, the fact that they really wanted to just, you know, promote women and encourage women, and yet they couldn't get it together on their own among the three of them.
Yeah, Alice was a great secretary to her, that's for sure. Did you know of any of her secretaries? Did you base it on anybody
at
all, or...?
Well, I did in one sense. A really good friend of mine had been Oprah Winfrey's personal assistant.
Ooh, nice job.
for many, many years. And when I met her, we were working in another place, and I saw the way she took care of the owner of the it was an interior design company, and I saw the way she took care of her. And I remember her stories of how she took care of, and she called her Miss Winfrey. Always to this day, it's Miss Winfrey. And I thought, you know what? That's how Alice would have been for Helen. She would have been that protective and that, you know, that anticipating everything that she could possibly need. So all she had to do was focus on running that magazine. She didn't have to worry about, you know, picking up dry cleaning or, you know, she's going to have a pencil, that was going to be sharp, or a cup of coffee or lunch that she wouldn't eat, you know.
Right, right.
Allie was sort of there for whatever she needed.
So it's almost like the opposite of The Devil Wears Prada, where not particularly kind to her secretaries versus
right.
Secretary-boss relationship was very contentious, whereas this was supportive because they, you know, really believed in what was happening in the dream.
Right, right. And, you know, and Helen was the velvet hammer. She had a very gentle spirit and a way about her, but she was also incredibly sly. And she knew how to manipulate a situation to her advantage. But she did it with sugar. She did it with honey.
And that's what they say. You catch more, what is it, flies with honey?
Yeah. More flies with honey, yeah. Mm. Yeah, because when she did get upset, she just screeched like a bird, you know, and I don't think anybody took her seriously.
I think that's the other end of being the velvet hammer is when, like, you take the velvet off and you're like, what? People are like, ha, yeah, you're not really mad at me. And you're just like, no, it's... You know, you are. So I think that's kind of the other way. And I think, like, for sure, women in any position of power or authority, and that's that double standard. You know, you're supposed to be a certain way, and people mm-hmm. expect you to be one way, but then if you do it that way, you're being too hard, and there's really just kind of no winning. You know, you're either harsh or you're not being taken seriously, and I think we're still finding our way in that.
The men at Hearst magazine they wanted her to fail so badly. There was no way they wanted mm-hmm. her to succeed and make that Cosmopolitan magazine a success. I mean, they didn't think she was going to be able to do it.
And now it's
right.
Still
and when her first issue, mm-hmm. her first issue sells over 250,000 copies.
Right.
You know, and they're like, oh God, now what do we do? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Helen built Hearst. She, you know, not that they were like going under necessarily, but she elevated Hearst Publications, you know, all across the board.
And now Cosmopolitan is still, like, there's several copies in every library, doctor's office,
yep.
you name it.
And I don't know in how many different
salons.
Countries it's in now. But
uh-huh. So really.
And so she, you know, and to think that this one tiny 105-pound woman yeah. changed the whole face of that industry, you know, from the cover to the content to the way, you know, magazines were once upon a time, you know, we waited for that to show up every month.
Right.
You know, and turn to the bedside astrologer. And
so what are you working on now?
So I am just finished a new book called The Social Graces, and it's the story of Mrs. Astor and Alva Vanderbilt vying for control of New York society during the Gilded Ooh, Age.
That sounds fascinating. I will love
so
to read that
really,
one also.
Really, really fun stuff. So that comes out January of 2021.
Oh, 2021.
We
have
to wait that long.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a long time.
Well, please, let's book you now to talk about that one.
Oh, I would love that. I would love that. It, you know, I'm having so much fun with the material and, you know, getting to know Alva Vanderbilt. She's a really fascinating woman. And so is Caroline Astor. I mean, she's complicated, you know, and try and bring that out on the page because they were more than just these rich women.
Okay.
And they were more alike than I think either one of them realized.
Mm-hmm. Did you tour for your book, Park Avenue Summer?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Were you in this area in New York? Did you come here?
I was in Brooklyn. I was in Connecticut, Avon, Connecticut, and in Brooklyn.
Books? Did you go to Books or Magic? Is that where you were?
No, I was at the Bookmark in Brooklyn. And I was at the Avon, Connecticut Public Library.
Oh, so you go to public
and I was
libraries.
There I was there with Susan Meisner.
Oh, very
and
nice.
Chanel Clayton.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, and it was great.
We'd
yeah,
love to have
really
you here
wonderful.
In the next book if you want to come out to Long Island.
Yes.
We'd love to have you
I
here.
I would love that.
Very
I
cool.
would absolutely love to do that.
Yeah. And maybe you'll get some inspiration for another book from some of Long Island's history.
Yeah.
Not that Long Island history hasn't been written about enough, but there's always other ways.
There's always people are, you know, that's what's so amazing to me, like with all the World War II books, which I love, mm-hmm. people are still uncovering new stories that we haven't heard yet.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
and we're
there's always room.
There's so
always
many Gilded Age mansions hanging out here that they all have a story. Anyway,
the Vanderbilt. Yeah, there's the Vanderbilt Museum right out here on Long Island also. I don't know which part of the family owned that, but there is a museum.
They had, what was it, Idle Hour was on Long Island.
Uh-huh.
And that was Alva. But I think all of them at some point, you know, they had so many houses, it was impossible to keep track of them.
Which is completely baffling.
And they weren't just houses, they were mansions.
They
mansions.
Were, and they barely They're ever stayed there, ever. They're like, that's my
I
March
know,
house
I
that I go to every three Marches. Like, that's not a thing that anybody really understands these days.
But, yeah, their cottages in Newport, they were there for, what, 6 weeks out of the year? And they were just enormous.
And those houses are unbelievable. Unreal.
Well, yeah. I wanted to thank you so much, Renee and Evelyn.
Thank you.
And so we're going to close this chapter of Turn the Page, but we will, Evelyn and I will see you again, Renee, or speak to you again when this new book comes out. What's it going to be called? Do you have a title yet, or you can't say?
The Social Graces.
Oh, right. You mentioned that before. Got it. Okay. Thank you.
We look forward to that book, Renee.
All right.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.